This is the Poetry Magazine podcast for June 2012. I'm Christian Wyman, editor of Poetry Magazine.
And I'm Don Scher, senior editor of the magazine. On the Poetry Magazine podcast, we feature readings from poets in the current issue.
This month, we're going to hear work from Claudia Emerson.
On her face, the boredom she abhorred, then perfected.
And from Stuart Dybeck.
The inbred need to pray is what makes God necessary.
Then we're going to talk with Mary Ruffel about poetry and fear.
It is the fear that you were doing something that everyone in the world thinks is crazy.
We also have poems this month by William Logan, Kim Adonizio, and Dean Young. And our occasional feature, The View From Here, is back. These are essays from people in various fields who comment on their experience of poetry. We've actually done 10 of these installments now.
And among others, this time we've got Lou Reed evoking the spirit of his old teacher, Delmore Schwartz.
We have an iron worker named Josh Warren who's writing about memorizing, of all things, Wallace Stevens and W.H. Auden while he works with heavy metals.
And although he's not heavy metal, we also have singer-songwriter Will Oldham on why poetry is inaccessible to him, except if it's in a song.
As our regular podcast listeners know by now, 2012 is the 100th anniversary of the magazine. We've been marking the occasion in every issue by reprinting notable poems that have appeared in poetry over the years. We've got an anthology coming out this fall, and Don and I found so many poems that we loved that we just couldn't put into the anthology, and we thought it was just too much of a shame to leave them out of the magazine.
Yeah, in this particular issue, we've got poems by all kinds of people like Ruth Stone and Adrienne Rich and Rita Dove. And it's a lovely sequence that we put together here.
They happen to be all women, but it's an accident. We were putting them together and sort of arranging the poems by subjects, and then we noticed they were all women. And
a good poem's a good poem.
A good poem's a good poem. Yeah. Don, is there one that you particularly liked or want to talk about?
There's a very short excerpt from a longer poem by Kathleen Rain. She won the Harriet Monroe Memorial Prize in 1952, but in 1992 she won the Queen's Gold Medal for Poetry. She was around for a long time and was also fascinating as a scholar of Blake. And yet I think she's not as read as she might be. So this is a small little poem. It's from The Hollow Hill. Smaller than pollen grain, smaller than seed, of bitterberry red. Do not look for the small. The door has no size at all. Some of sorrow have made a well, and deep have seen, in daylight, far stars glimmer pale in another heaven. This seems almost Blakean. The bitterberry red reminded me of that, but also the sort of visionary quality, even in these two short stanzas. Some of sorrow have made a well, and deep have seen. This all sounds Blakean to me, and yet it seems very contemporary.
Oh my gosh, yes, and that beautiful nether heaven. Don't you wish you had thought of that?
And it's kind of an off-rhyme there, seen and nether heaven.
Yeah.
It makes you want to see it.
Yeah. There was one here that I was moved by for personal reasons. I mean professionally too. I liked the poem very much. It almost went into the anthology. It's been in all the other poetry anthologies. It's by Denise Levertov, and it's called Invocation. And I studied with Denise Levertov. She was teaching at Stanford. I was there her last year, so I was in the very last class that she ever taught. And she was an important person for me, as odd as it seemed at the time, because I was writing very formal poems, and she hated formal poems. I mean, she didn't just not have patience for them. She despised them. But as it happened, we got along famously. We had a correspondence after I left Stanford about some things that I was writing and about whether formal poetry could still exist. It's interesting. You just read that poem by Kathleen Rain, very formal poem, which was helpful to me in a lot of ways. This is called Invocation. Silent, about to be parted from house, wood creaking, trying to sigh, impatient, clicking of squirrel teeth in the attic, denuded beds, couches stripped of serapes. Deep snow shall block all entrances and oppress the roof and darken the windows. Oh, Larry's, don't leave. The house yawns like a bear. Guard its profound dreams for us, that it return to us when we return. I like mostly that last line. It couldn't exist without the straightforward language of the rest of the poem, which doesn't call any attention to itself at all, unlike the poem you read. But it does show what you can do with that kind of plain-spoken language when you suddenly introduce a surprising line like that at the end.
Well, it has all of the strongest virtues of free verse. You can tell she couldn't have done this without scholarship and mastery of all the formal verse you can imagine. This is a very accomplished poem.
Oh, yeah. She used to hold poems up in workshops and yell, "This is a score," if someone was not reading it correctly. You know, she insisted that you have this long pause at the end of a line. It was quite awkward, really. But at any rate, it did teach you something about free verse. Our June issue also has a portfolio of poems from W.S. DiPiero, who's a longtime contributor to Poetry Magazine. He's the winner of the 2012 Ruth Lilly Poetry Prize for Lifetime Achievement. We've got an interesting portfolio from DiPiero. He is not only a poet, but a well-known art critic and cultural critic. So we have paired the poems with excerpts from his prose and even a painting of him, which he writes about. I'm going to read this one poem called The Green Man, and I wanted to read this one because I also, oddly, have a personal connection with a character who's named in this poem. It's called The Green Man. Rum-dum from last night's shrubbery tryst exhales soot, fern seed, shoots and vines, brings his hot breath from the city park's wood, saying a song we don't understand through the briar and bay leaves of his beard. And in Philadelphia, 1954, out of late autumn's darkening, he came, a junk man, lugging a pin fruit cart, straw bristling his face, crying a name. Or from manholes in other cities, his holographic ectoplasm greets us when traffic lights turn green. Uncover, and there he is, membranous Caliban, alone with sewer rats, or stumble-bum Puck, unnameable solids crusting nails and toes, bringing us his dark. Or our neighborhood's soused John John, cobra down at heel, boots skidding at my feet among the maddening jasmine, when I grab too late to save him, growls, "I can save you, darling pigs, behold, behold, and maybe I'll help." So this is the poem about bums that you see everywhere. It sort of makes them a kind of every man. The one that I knew was John John. He slept on my stoop on many occasions. But the power of the poem, it's in that part where it says, bringing us his dark. It makes us feel our own culpability in not feeling these people we walk past.
DiPiero is that rarity among writers, someone whose poetry and prose are really strong and powerful and in different ways, though they do share characteristics in their intensity. And alongside this poem are some prose bits of his. And the second one that goes with this poem starts off, "The man was liquefying before my eyes, his body a runny fuddle of dark bundled clothes and sooty skin." And it goes on, it's not only the most vivid description of this scene that we're all too used to, but an indictment of the circumstances that foster its continuation everywhere around us.
Claudia Emerson's book, Late Wife, won the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry in 2006. Emerson has also served as the Poet Laureate of Virginia, her home state.
We have two of her poems in the June issue that are from a sequence of eight poems.
I wanted to try to create a small sequence of poems about people, things, even words that are on the brink of disappearing or, I guess, extinction.
Each poem in the sequence is called Early Elegy, and then it's followed by the subject. We asked her to tell us about those subjects in order.
Headmistress, telephone booth, cursive, barber, operator, drive-in movie theater, wisdom teeth, and smallpox.
Each of the eight poems has only eight lines.
To me, eight lines will always connote the octave of a sonnet. Some of the traditional properties of the octave would be to propose something, ask a question, and the fact that there is no answer to these seemed kind of fun for me.
We have the first and the last poems of her sequence. They make an interesting pair. Here is the first one called Early Elegy, Headmistress.
The word itself, prim, retired, its artifact, her portrait above the fireplace. On her face, the boredom she abhorred, then perfected, her hands held upward, their emptiness a revision, cigarette and brandy snifter painted intolerably out. To leave her this lesser gesture, what next? Or shrugged whatever. From the waist down, she was never there.
I remember we laughed when we read this the first time, and we're still laughing. I can't.
Right.
It's sort of inexplicable.
But it's serious.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
not a funny poem. And yeah. It's an indictment, really. I mean, headmistress. It's a character who is as awful as the word sounds. In this case, it's this sort of uncanny that Claudia Emerson has hit upon words for these bygone things or things that will be bygone, and the words are so ugly. Smallpox. What an ugly word.
Yeah. Well, I like the, I always respond to these little implosions of sound, like lesser gesture and boredom she abhorred. You know, those sounds echoing each other in this poem so perfectly and so curtly. In this poem, they carve out this pretty pathetic and sad character.
Yeah, there's just some wistfulness for this strange and kind of nasty world that has been superseded by a different kind of nasty world.
Speaking of which, let's hear the second poem, which is the final poem in Emerson's sequence, and it's called Smallpox. Now that the disease has been eradicated, the only remaining samples of the virus it's only in one or two laboratories.
Early Elegy, Smallpox. The world has certified itself rid of all but the argument to eradicate or not the small stock of variola, frozen, quarantined, a dormancy it has refused just once for a woman behind a sterile lens, her glass slide a clearest, most becoming pain. How could it resist slipping away with her, that discreet first pock?
Well, you have to respond to that word pain, first of all, right? I mean, that her glass slide a clearest, most becoming pain.
Yeah.
And suddenly that word just explodes into its other meaning. And it makes also the last word, pock, painful.
How could it resist slipping away with her, that discreet first pock?
You know, Auden says that poetry is the clear expression of mixed feelings.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you feel in these, is this mingled sympathy and horror. And she manages to cram that into the language so wonderfully.
We should say, as Emerson told us, the poem took some liberties with the truth.
The person who was infected was actually, she was a medical photographer, so that part is true, but she wasn't actually photographing it or looking at it when she was infected. She was on the telephone in the room above where it is, ordering supplies, and she was infected and died.
Stuart Dybek has written quite a lot about Chicago, his hometown. After many years living in Michigan, he's now a distinguished writer in residence at Northwestern University in Evanston, just north of Chicago.
We lead off the June issue with three poems by Dybek from a book that he's working on now.
The autobiographical note on that book is that I grew up in an inner city neighborhood. And when I went to graduate school, I went to a school in Iowa. And it was the first time in my life I had an opportunity to live on the Great Plains in a rural place.
This poem describes an old, decrepit garage that used to be a barn. It's called Scythe.
In the barn demoted to garage, the axe in a cherry stump can't be budged. Daylight perforates siding despite the battered armor of license plates. Corroded colors, same state. Decay. Their date's the only history of whoever tilled the soil and left as a welcome the skull of a possum nailed to the door, and the trail of lime to the torn sack in a corner where cobwebs festoon a scythe. Rusted sharp, it sings when he grips its splintery handle, swings, and crowns topple from Queen Anne's lace.
It's funny that a city boy could nail that last line like that. That's so striking, and an unbelievable line.
Yeah, but is he talking of Williams there? Or is, I mean, how do you mention Queen Anne's lace in a poem and not talk about William Cross Williams?
Yeah.
But I couldn't really figure out what the connection was. What I love is festoon a scythe, cobwebs festoon a scythe. There are all kinds of touches there, and though you probably couldn't hear this when it's being read, it has very subtle rhymes throughout. Soil, skull, garage, budged despite plate, decay, and history.
I love about English that you, because it doesn't have the kinds of rhymes that romance languages have, you can find all kinds of other music in it. You kind of get into that nerdy, that totally nerdy poet mindset about the peculiarity of your rhymes. And I'm never sure that a reader even really thinks along those lines. I suppose in some ways, if the reader doesn't notice it, it's all the better. But that was part of the play of the poem that I enjoyed.
Dybeck is much better known as a fiction writer, and he is a fantastic fiction writer, but he has wonderful talents as a poet, too.
Let's hear another poem from Stuart Dybeck. This one is called The Supplicant.
When I wrote it, it reminded me of another piece I wrote called Strays. And at the heart of both those pieces are women who kind of have an empathetic eye out for the small creatures of the planet. In Strays, the woman lives in a working-class neighborhood, and any wounded animal, any stray animal, any lost animal, she feels the need to nurture, to take care of. The Supplicant begins with a very like woman. The supplicant prays for birds before an ancient icon, a stray cat. The inbred need to pray is what makes God necessary, and not, she says, the other way around. Beyond that, it's all mystery. So don't question why man creates gods that demand sacrifice, condemning mortals to spend their lives trying to praise Godhead into mercy. Better instead to ask the frog to bless the fly, and once the cheese is in the trap, to beg forgiveness from the rat.
The concision is amazing. I mean, you just don't expect a fiction writer to be able to pare down the stuff into those staccato rhythms and line breaks and things. When you see it on the page, it's very spare.
Yeah, it really is. And it's a poem for our times. It's a very secular and yet not unmysterious poem. One of the things that I admire in it is that it gets rid of that idea of Williams, no ideas but in things, which is a deadest idea around. And it enables him to say things like the inbred need to pray is what makes God necessary, and not, she says, the other way around, so that we actually get a statement in the poem that we were asked to deal with. Is that true or is that not true?
Right.
I'm not sure. I agree with that. But the rest of the poem then develops that with images, and it does make an argument in an old-fashioned kind of way.
Yeah, it really does. And in this case, we're asking a frog to bless the fly. We're begging forgiveness from the rat. I mean, these creatures that are around us, instead of being emblematic of some sort of muzzy, you know, benevolent kind of creator, is really asking what is being sacrificed. And these little creatures are being sacrificed all around us all the time. And this sad woman who wants to rescue them really has her work cut out for her, because she can't. I mean, you just can't. You know, nobody could rescue all these tiny creatures.
Yeah, it's a wonderful tribute and elegy at the same time, and celebration at the same time.
Yeah, I think so.
Women who lie alone at midnight because there's no one else to lie to. Women who lie alone at midnight, at noon in the laundromat, destroying their own socks. Women who lie alone at midnight, Hans Brinker or the Silver Skates.
That's Mary Ruffel reading her poem Women in Labor, which was in last September's issue and also on the September podcast.
Mary Ruffel's book of essays, Madness, Rack, and Honey, is coming out this summer. In the June issue, we have her essay, On Fear, and she joins us to talk about it from Vermont. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
Now, Mary, you begin your essay with an arresting sentence that we put on the back cover of the issue. We always like to put something very striking back there. The sentence is, "I suppose as a poet, among my fears can be counted the deep-seated uneasiness that one day it will be revealed that I consecrated my life to an imbecility." Now, Don and I are poets, and I think we understand exactly what you mean, but could you maybe describe that fear for our listeners?
It is the fear that you are doing something that everyone in the world thinks is crazy, and
yeah.
Nobody understands why you do it, except other people who do it, but they are few and far between. But it's really interesting that you begin with that, because this essay was actually written in 1997, and it was written very shortly before I got lost in the great woods of my middle life, which happens to all of us. And rereading it and revising it for publication in the book, I was thinking, whoa, if I wrote this today, would I do things differently? And I realized that fear is no longer with me, although that fear that I had chosen to do the wrong thing with my life, I think is very common in midlife. And I think that I've totally made peace with that. It's not a fear of mine. And yet, I think as we drop or lose fears, we gain or add new ones.
Yeah, that's funny. It makes me think of a quote from Thomas Merton. He said, one morning you wake up and you realize that all religion is really just, it all just seems a little ridiculous. But you guess you'll just stick with it anyway at this point.
Exactly. Well, that was his chosen, you know, vocation in life. I think it's very, very common. I mean, it's not exclusive to artists.
Now, I was noticing recently that there's a lot of scientific writing coming out now about the difference between emotions and feelings. This is kind of a pretty hot topic, I think. And it sounds like you've stumbled upon this before some of the experts. In your view, is fear an emotion or a feeling? And what do you think the difference between them is?
I think that it can be either, depending on the nature of the fear. Obviously, when we smell smoke, that's a hardwired reaction for survival. But when we are sitting around in a hammock on a beautiful day, feeling afraid that we've wasted our life, that's very much a feeling.
You're right. As far back as I could remember, every minute of my life has been an emergency in which I was paralyzed with fear. That sounds confessional, but I mean, the weird thing is that in this essay, it somehow isn't. What do you mean by that exactly?
That always inside of me, in my unconsciousness, is a deep-seated anxiety about the fact I'm alive and wondering if I'm doing the right thing with that aliveness.
You know, when I was reading this, it brought back to my mind the kind of fearfulness you have as a child when you're just beginning to find your way, you know, around the world or in school or something like that. And what I was wondering is, you know, you write that fear can lead to an emergency of feeling that often results in a poem. I had two questions here. One is, are poets people who not only don't outgrow this fear, but seize upon it? And can you describe any emergencies of feeling that have resulted in a poem for you?
Well, I very much think that poets are people who, artists, I should never just say poets, artists, because poets are artists. Their life is a life of awareness, becoming increasingly aware. And I think this is what they have in common with children who have much less of an awareness of something like, say, time, but can get lost in a raindrop that is falling down the windowpane. And when you pay that kind of attention to anything, you see a side of it that can be frightening. I mean, was it Blake who said, if you look at a pine knot long enough, you'll go mad? As far as my own experience of an emergency of feeling leading to a poem, you know, I will say this, when I was younger, I would just face the blank page, and now I'm at an age where I probably shouldn't be saying this, but I don't bother to write a poem unless there's an emergency of feeling. Now, yeah. That might not be apparent on the page, but without the feeling that there's an emergency of feeling, I'm really not compelled to write a poem.
You know, Blake thought that if you looked at a pine knot, I can't remember if that's what it was, I'll take your word for it, if you looked at it long enough, you'd go mad. It was because you were looking into the design of God. It was because you were entering some perfect, pure design. You seem to be saying, if you look at it long enough, something different, right?
No, not necessarily. I mean, epiphanies can come from above or below. But I talk a little bit about, in the essay, an aspect of fear is that dread of the divine, dread of God. Something that we can't comprehend can often result in our being anxious. Therefore, we cannot look at his face or speak his name because we would be overcome.
Well, speaking of Blake, I mean, you build a really convincing case that fear is actually at the heart of a great deal of poetry and not just as a motivator. Are there some examples, other examples that come to mind?
Pascal. I didn't use this in the essay, but the eternal silence of these infinite spaces frightens me.
Yeah.
There's also a great deal of beauty in the eternal silence of infinite spaces. I suppose the eternal silence of infinite spaces can comfort some people, or that it can frighten some people. And there are poems which reflect, thankfully, all different views of the eternal silence of infinite spaces.
You know, you could also argue that desire is at the heart of poetry, but you say that fear is desire's dark dress. Can you draw that out a little bit for us?
Be careful what you wish for. That's not drawing it out, but...
That was pretty good.
Your essay, it moves to a discussion of Keats and negative capability, a concept that you say is almost always taken out of context and misunderstood and overused. And could you explain that just a little bit and what it has to do with fear for you?
Well, everyone uses it, assuming that Keats possessed it to a great degree. I point out in the essay he was not speaking of himself, he was speaking of Shakespeare. And if you read the poems and the letters, you'll see that he was frightfully anxious and reaching after all kinds of fact and reason, but then obviously was able at moments to completely subside, especially when confronted with the purely physical world. I mean, just the physicality, the cream of the physical world.
Yeah. And of course, he has that great poem, "When I Have Fears That I May Cease to Be Before My Pen Has Gleaned My Teeming Brain." I mean, a poem that's very much about your whole subject there.
Exactly. That poem is a perfect example of listing anxieties and fears, but then at the end, just standing on the shore and looking out to sea.
You revel in contradictions that suggest your own negative capabilities, maybe. For instance, you say, "I am much less afraid than I ever was in my youth of everything. That is a fact. At the same time, I feel more afraid than ever." So how are these two statements not in opposition?
I think they're not in opposition by the very fact that some tension between them keeps me alive and allows me to be. If they were in total opposition, I think I would be in the kind of crisis that thankfully is behind me, that sort of middle life woods that we all enter in one way or another. And if you come out of that, it must be on account of an abiding sense that your own contradictions are supporting each other and allowing you to go on, and that they're safe.
That's a beautiful way of saying it, and it's a very beautiful essay. And Mary Ruffel, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thank you very, very much. Thank you.
You can read Mary Ruffel's essay and everything else you heard on this program in the June 2012 issue of Poetry Magazine and online at poetrymagazine.org.
Let us know what you thought of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org.
The Poetry Magazine podcast is recorded by Ed Herman and produced by Curtis Fox Productions.
The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Don Scher.
And I'm Christian Wyman. Thanks for listening.